The Guardian. In the mid-1990s, a special little mouse crept its way into the media headlines. Pink, hairless, and fragile-looking, the little animal looked every bit as you would expect a mouse might, with one exception. A human ear was growing from its back. Ear mouse, as it came to be known, hinted that scientists were on the brink of extraordinary new capabilities that included being able to grow body parts in the lab. 20 years on, this vision is becoming a reality. 3D cell cultures, known as organoids, are allowing scientists to experiment on disembodied organs derived from human cells. And in recent years, it has become possible to grow miniature versions of the human brain. So how are these miniature brains made?
I decided to try that on these aggregates of cells, and we ended up with these beautiful three-dimensional brain tissues.
And what ethical issues does the work raise?
Have I created something that actually has human enough characteristics that we have to worry about the ethics of it?
I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
Hi, Madeline. Good to speak to you.
To learn more about the making of these organoids, I turn to one researcher at the forefront of this field.
I'm Madeline Lancaster, and I'm a group leader and neuroscientist at the MRC Laboratory of Molecular Biology in Cambridge.
I started by asking Madeline how she came to be working on organoids.
Basically, what happened was some of those cells didn't stick to the dish that I was trying to culture them on, and they ended up making these balls of tissue. I could have just thrown those things away and said, well, my experiment failed. But I thought they looked so interesting that I started doing some experiments with them a little bit more and trying to characterize them and see what they were doing and also optimize the conditions to make that happen more reliably. And then also with the discovery by Hans Klaver's group in the Netherlands, where they had made these things called intestinal organoids, they found that if they grew those stem cells in a gel of proteins, a very protein-rich gel, then they could get those cells to make these 3D structures that looked a lot like the intestine. I decided to try that on these aggregates of cells, and that really bumped it up a notch, and we ended up with these beautiful three-dimensional brain tissues.
And then you took the work on to use human cells, is that right?
Yes, exactly. And actually, we switched to human cells quite early on because we realized that if we were going to be in vitro in a dish, there's no reason why we can't do that with human cells, and that's a more relevant system, of course.
Could you just tell me a bit about how these blobs of brain tissue develop and what you have to do to coax them into that process?
It's a fairly simple process where you just take these very potent stem cells and you allow them to start dividing and trying to make the different cells of the body, but you put them in a special media formulation that kind of prevents the other cells of the body and promotes the brain tissue to form. And then we put them in this protein-rich gel that I mentioned, and they spontaneously self-organize and make these really beautiful three-dimensional tissues. And then sort of the third step of it is to put them in some agitation. So, for example, a spinning bioreactor, as we call it, or just sort of a shaker thing, basically to move the fluid around them. And that allows for better nutrient and oxygen exchange, so we can get these really quite large developing brain tissues.
How big are they? And if you could look inside of them, what kind of structures do you see?
Yeah, so they end up being around about half a centimeter usually, give or take 1 or 2 millimeters. When you cut them open, in the very sort of inside regions, you see these fluid-filled cavities, which look a lot like the ventricles of the brain. And then next to that, you have the neural stem cells. And then those neural stem cells are producing neurons, and the neurons go over to the surface of the brain organoid. And that's exactly the kind of architecture that you would see in an actual brain. But the difference really is that, so we have these different brain regions in there, and because it's spontaneously self-organizing, these different brain regions are made in a kind of a random fashion. So that means that one part of the organoid might have a cerebral cortex, the large folded part of our brain, but another part might have a retina, and a completely other part might have, let's say, hippocampal tissue, the part that's responsible for learning and memory. But they're randomly distributed relative to one another, and so it doesn't really have the overall shape of a brain. But we can still look at each one of those individual components and learn something about them. So I often give the analogy that it's a bit like if you took an airplane and you took it apart and then you put one wing on the top of the plane and you put the cockpit in the middle and the engine at the back, you know, and the wheels on the side, that plane, of course, would never fly. But we can study each one of those components and learn something about how each one of those components develops.
So apart from the fact that it's just fundamentally cool and interesting being able to grow these mini brains or blobs of brain tissue in a dish, what kind of questions can scientists answer using this technique?
Well, I think it just opens up the door to a whole new realm of exploration. And I think this is reflected in the fact that there are so many labs now using this method. I was recently at a meeting and I think there were maybe 100 labs just at that meeting that were using it. So it's getting pretty widely implemented now. And the reason is because we can use it to look at so many different questions. And so people who are interested in things like, you know, human neurodevelopmental conditions, like, for example, congenital disorders. We've used it to look at a genetic form of microcephaly where the brain is too small. Others are using it to look at things like lissencephaly where the brain is smooth, or other types of brain malformations. There are others who are using it to look at a little bit later onset, but still developmental human conditions like autism, for example, or even later onset things like depression and schizophrenia, and then even later onset neurodegenerative conditions like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. So because we now have this human model now where we can actually look at human brain tissue, it opens the door to a huge range of human neurological conditions that we couldn't look at necessarily in animal models, or that were not very well modeled in those animal models.
According to Madeline, her lab is now turning to a more fundamental question. What makes the human brain so special? While this work is only a few years old, she says, their ability to create mouse and human organoids has allowed the lab to study, compare and investigate the differences in brain architecture and genetics between the two species. Other labs have extended that comparative analysis to study similarities and differences between humans and other primates. I spoke with Gray Kamp, a group leader at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany. I asked him about his work.
So, you know, in the same way that we can generate stem cells from human blood or skin, we can do the same thing with chimpanzees, gorillas, orangs, and other great apes. And from these stem cells, we can follow the same protocols to generate these structured three-dimensional tissues, recapitulating brain development. So these cerebral organoids, some people are calling them. And we can compare the human organoids to the chimp organoids and try to figure out what are the similarities and what might be some differences between cortex development and the development of other brain regions. And, you know, this question has been really difficult to address in the past because it's difficult to access tissue at the corresponding time points. And so now that we can recapitulate these developmental programs in culture, we can really start to ask the question, you know, what makes ourselves unique from those of our closest living relatives? And so, you know, we and other groups around the world have been doing these experiments, and we're finding that vast majority of at least gene expression patterns are the same between the human cortex during human cortex development and chimpanzee cortex development. You know, of course, we do find some intriguing differences, and we're trying to follow up on this and figure out if, you know, in addition to gene expression changes, what other features of cell biology in the brain are different.
According to Gray, these methods can potentially provide some of the first clear biological evidence that our brains are different in some meaningful way. However, these are just miniature models of brains, and they don't come close to capturing the complexity of a real human brain.
So, Madeline, could you just...
I wondered if there are labs trying to make these organoids bigger, more realistic, and, well, brainier.
There are definitely labs that are trying to not necessarily make them bigger just to make them bigger, but that are interested in trying to get them a little bit further in their development And the reason is, of course, we'd like to be able to study also later stages rather than just early fetal development. It would be nice to also be able to study later events in brain development in order to model later onset kinds of conditions. So there are definitely labs working to do that. And one of the main hurdles that prevent organoids from being able to develop to a later stage is the lack of vascularization, which then also relates to the size, actually. So because they're not vascularized, the centers of those organoids are not getting enough nutrients and oxygen. And even with the agitation that we described, it's not enough to keep the central core of the organoid healthy. And so although there are a lot of healthy neurons around the periphery, the inside is basically dead. So that's obviously not mimicking the kind of architecture that an actual brain would have. So there are labs that are working to try to vascularize these things in vitro by introducing endothelial cells and other types of vascular support cells. And then there are also labs that are working to do that by basically transplanting organoids into an animal host, where then the host would provide that vasculature. And both approaches are looking promising. In particular, there was a transplantation study published in Nature Biotechnology just recently showing that they could get better survival of neurons within the organoids when they transplanted into a mouse. But the size was not really expanded. And there's a lot of things, I think, that could still be tinkered with there to try to improve it even further. So I think we'll see, but I think there are definitely approaches to try to do that. Although I don't think we'll reach a complete, you know, completely fully formed human-sized brain.
As Madeline mentions, the ability to create and study brain organoids can pave the way for breakthroughs in our understanding of neurological illnesses. And according to Gray, this technology can help scientists unlock our evolutionary past and help us understand what makes us so special. Both agree that the science is still in its very early stages. But then why are some experts raising concerns?
The closer you come to replicating a human brain and a human body, the more you have to worry. Have I created something that actually has human enough characteristics that we have to worry about the ethics of it?
More on that after the break.
Welcome to The Start, a brand new weekly podcast from The Guardian.
Without those kind of engaging with reality, I will not become I worry today.
Each episode reveals a story of artistic beginnings, as told by some of the great artists of our time.
For me, Scandalicious, so much of that was also about me finding my way.
Focusing on one piece, they share how these early moments of creativity shaped them, the influence it had on their subsequent work, and what the piece now means to them in retrospect.
The most I've ever seen in any room, you know, looking at any kind of art, was in Mr. Barnes's two rooms.
To find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search The Start on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Hannah Devlin. Before the break, we heard from neuroscientist Madeline Lancaster about organoid research and what she believes to be the exciting possibilities for the field. We also heard from Gray Kamp from the Max Planck Institute in Germany about how these methods can help researchers study our ancient evolutionary past and help us understand what makes our species so special. Many experts agree that this work is groundbreaking, but it is also edging into controversial territory.
Hello.
Hi, this is Hank here.
Hi, good to speak to you. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
No problem.
I spoke with Hank Greeley, the director of the Center for Law and the Biosciences at Stanford Law School. Hank recently co-authored a paper for Nature magazine with a group of 17 experts raising ethical issues around developments in the field. I started by asking him what led the group to start raising red flags
three different things led to us writing this paper, and they're all ways to try to come up with surrogates for human brain research. I mean, the best way to study living human brains is to study them inside living humans, but living humans were really crummy laboratory animals. We lie, we cheat, we have lawyers, you can't slice us and dice us the way you'd like to. And so we try to get things that are similar to human brains in human bodies, but that aren't humans. One way to do that is through neural organoids. Another way to do that is to try to put human brain tissue into non-human animals, so at least you're seeing something in vivo, even if it's not in the same species. And a third route is to try to take human brain tissue, either tissue left over from neurosurgery, tissue removed during neurosurgery, or tissue from dead humans' brains, and try to keep that tissue alive outside the body. Whether you're actually keeping the piece of brain alive or not, when you're keeping its cells alive, is an interesting and difficult question. But for each of those three, you're really trying to get something that is a surrogate for human brain in human head, but that doesn't raise the kinds of research ethics problems that you get when you're doing research directly on people. The problem that the paper points out is that the better you are at making a surrogate, the closer you come to replicating a human brain in a human body, the more you back into the same kinds of ethical problems that led you to create the surrogates to begin with. The more you have to worry, have I created something that actually has human enough characteristics that we have to worry about the ethics of it?
Where are the areas that you think are most ethically worrying, or where we have to kind of think about what's going on the most? Are there areas that are starting to cross into a gray area ethically?
Well, I think there are some issues that you always have to think about and worry about apart from the humanization question. The deeper question, the scary question is, are these becoming conscious? Are they becoming sentient? Are they becoming somehow human? But even before that, you get the questions of, say, the consent. If you're taking tissues or cells from a living person, what do you have to tell them about how you're going to use them? Some people might not want their cells put into rat brains, for example. So you've got that set of issues, a fairly standard set of research ethics issues that need to be confronted in this slightly different context. The bigger question, though, is this question of sentience, consciousness, humanism. We should start thinking about that now, because this field is expanding at such a quick rate that no one can guarantee that we won't be close to it in 5 years or 10 years or 15 years. And 5 years isn't a long time to begin thinking about what kinds of ethics constraints we want to put, especially in a setting where it's hard for us to measure the underlying quality we're looking for. I mean, if we understood what human consciousness in you and me actually looks like, we'd be better off trying to figure out what consciousness looks like in an organoid. But we don't even know the first part. We don't know what consciousness looks like at the brain level in living humans who are clearly conscious. It makes it really hard to figure out, are we getting into questions with pieces of brain tissue, with human brain organoids, or with non-human animals that have some human brain tissue in them?
There's things where they're putting humanized brain cells into the brains of mice, for instance. So you have some kind of in-between brain. And how do you even start to ask at what point that becomes too human and not mouse enough for it to be allowed as a lab animal?
Right. That's a great example. And I wrote something about that 11 years ago. One of my colleagues at Stanford, Irv Weissman, wanted to do just that experiment. He wanted to replace the neurons in a mouse's brain with human neurons. And that raised the question, are you going to get a mouse that stands up on its hind legs and says, "Hi, I'm Mickey"? You know, what are you getting, a human brain inside a mouse? And we looked at that and came up with some recommendations. One was, worry about the architecture, not about the bricks. It's not so much whether the neurons are human or mouse, it's what are they building. And there are some structures that are found in human brains, like a very complicated visual cortex, that aren't found in mouse brains. And some structures found in mouse brains, like whisker barrels, because their whiskers are very acute sensory organs, that aren't found in human brains. So look at the architecture, look at the behavior, look at the size. I don't think anybody's too worried about a mouse brain exhibiting serious human characteristics because it's a thousandth the size of a human brain. But if you were to put human brain stem cells into a, say, 3-week-old chimpanzee embryo, then I think there'd be reason to be more concerned. So look at what it's building, look at behavior, look at size constraints to try to get a sense of how worried we should be. Ultimately, though, it's going to be a really difficult problem. We wanted to see if the mouse is displaying any human-like behaviors. But what does it look like for a mouse to display human-like behaviors? It doesn't have the vocal apparatus to speak, even if it wanted to. How would you really tell? And those are tough scientific and philosophical and ethical questions that we really should be better prepared for in advance of these kinds of brain surrogates becoming more and more complicated.
Hank says there are not currently good ways of monitoring consciousness. In fact, science hasn't fully defined what consciousness is yet. But I wondered whether there are ways to spot if a mini brain is getting to the point where it might be capable of having a thought or experiencing pain.
There's some interesting possibilities. One of the things we talked about in a paper is some work by Paola Arlotta at Harvard, where she had some retinal cells in her neural organoid. And when you shine the light on the retinal cells, the rest of the organoid responds. You can see a response there. That's an interesting sign that something's going on. You've created an input mechanism into that organoid. You can watch for electrical activity or patterns of electrical activity. So far, no one's seen an EEG from an organoid, but you do see neuronal firings. As those get more patterned and more organized, it's a sign that something more complicated is going on in the organoid. You'll see those anyway in rat brains that have human tissues in them, so you'll need to probe a little more carefully to see what's going on with those actual human cells with the human tissues in the rat brain. One of the real steps that would make us more concerned would be the ability to make the organoids, these human neural organoids, bigger. Right now, they're very severely size constrained. They're a hollow sphere. It's like a soccer ball that's about a half centimeter in diameter. They can't get bigger than that because they don't have blood vessels. So all the cells have to be close enough to the culture medium to be able to get oxygen and get sugar and get the things they need to survive. People, however, are trying to figure out ways to grow blood vessels for these. There was a recent paper, a group at UC Davis, that had succeeded in growing some blood vessels, organoids. And then there's a paper from a group in San Diego that showed that when you move human neural organoids into rats, the rat brains will actually start to grow blood vessels for the human organoids. Things like that that make the organoids become larger. Right now, there are only 2 or 3 million neurons compared to our brains, which are 89 billion neurons. But if you can make the organoids bigger, or you can put them together in what some people are calling assembloids that begin to have 1 billion cells or 2 billion cells, then there's more cause to be nervous about what's going on inside those and to figure out good ways to monitor them through MRI, through EEG, and through the other mechanisms we have to try to see what's happening inside those brain cells.
In your discussion paper, you aren't just simply suggesting that there should be a ban on anything beyond a certain point. You suggest the possibility of things like guardians for these organoids. Could you just tell me a bit about the sorts of solutions that you're proposing?
The paper we've written is in a context where we don't expect anybody to be able to create a full human brain, full human consciousness, to keep a complete human brain alive in a box. If we got to that stage, the recommendations might look a little different. Right now, we're worried about these intermediate positions where there may be the ability to feel pain, there may be the ability to have some experience, and what kinds of protections we should have in place for those entities. I don't know a better word to call them at this point than entities that have some kind of ability to sense or interact with their environment. There's a bit of a regulatory gap. If you do research with humans, you have to get approval from an ethics committee that does oversight to make sure that the humans aren't harmed, that the people aren't hurt, and that the risks are justified by the benefits. If you do research with animals, you have to do the same thing. You can't just do anything you want to a laboratory mouse. It has to be approved by a committee to make sure that the mouse is being treated humanely. When you're doing research with an organoid, there's really no regulatory body involved. It's not a human. It's not an animal. And yet, it could develop some of the characteristics we worry about, such as, for example, the ability to sense pain. So one of the things we were wondering about was either a regulatory body or perhaps someone who's responsible for looking after and taking care of the best interests of, say, the organoid. That's not to say we think the organoid is the same as a person, is the same as a child or, you know, a person who has a serious mental illness and needs a guardian, but they may have some interests and those interests may need someone to look after them.
Is there any legal precedent for this? And is there, are there structures within the law already that would provide for this kind of guardianship?
Nothing very direct. I think the closest you can come is guardianships for people who are incompetent, either because of disease or disability or because of their youth. But those are always for people. Perhaps the closest thing we've got is the regulations on research with non-human animals, where you do have to worry about treating them well, treating them humanely. There aren't guardians appointed for them exactly, but there are committees that are responsible for ensuring that the researchers are using them in appropriate ways. That may be the closest precedent we've got right now, but we may need to come up with some other precedents.
Going back to Madeline Lancaster and her groundbreaking work in this field, I wanted her to weigh in on the paper and the ethical concerns being raised.
I think what we look for more is, because it's very difficult to define what consciousness is. And of course, you can look for things like, you know, different brain waves and different behaviors like that. But I still don't think that that would even if we saw that, that would not necessarily say that it's necessarily to a cognitive level that we need to worry about. For example, an insect brain will show some signatures of consciousness. It will respond to painful stimuli in a way that looks kind of similar to the way that a human would respond. You know, it would run away from it or something. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we need to protect a cockroach to the same level that we need to protect a human. So I think that the signatures that we look for are sort of all of the building blocks that we know are important for both consciousness and also cognitive level that sort of sets humans apart. And that's something that I think we're very far away from with these tissues. And so what I'm talking about are basically, although we can't necessarily define what consciousness is all that well, we generally agree that it is an emergent property of a very complex system. And the increasing complexity of that neural network will also determine sort of the level of cognition that it could have. And I think the reason that humans are sort of special is because we have this very large brain of 86 billion neurons. And also we have a huge complexity there where each neuron is very highly connected, has much more complex sort of branching patterns. And also the different types of neurons are more complex than in other animals. So we can look for those kind of features. Do we have the entire complex network? Is it in the same architecture as the human brain is? And is it the same size or is it reaching something close to that size? Then we definitely have to worry. But as you can imagine, with our little mini brains, which are not organized and don't have the same architecture, they don't have all of the neuronal makeup that a human brain has, and they're not anywhere close to that 86 billion number. I think we're very far away from it.
According to Hank, experts raising the issues are aware that scientists aren't at the stage yet where they can create a full-sized human brain, but it's still a conversation that needs to be had. I asked him whether he thought people are talking about the issues as much as they should be.
I hope so. We'll see what the response is to the article and to the press coverage about the article. I think it is getting more attention. I will be happy when there are some governmental bodies or large, the Royal Society or the National Academy of Sciences, if someone comes up with some recommended guidelines or creates a committee to come up with guidelines, I think that would be a useful step forward. We will need to think about some new science in order to actually make some of these ethical decisions. They're both ethics questions and they're real science questions about how you would know what's going on inside this tissue that will need to be addressed. So we have time, if we make good use of it, before we get into the situation where these pieces of brain tissue are complex enough, large enough, organized enough that we seriously have to worry about them having sentience or consciousness. But we don't have a lot of time.
Last question. Would it definitely be wrong to make something that had sentience or consciousness if it paved the way for a treatment for Alzheimer's, for example?
That's an excellent question. It's one that our paper doesn't take up, other than implicitly. I don't know that it's wrong. I don't know that it's right. I think it would be wrong, though, for scientists to do it without a substantial public discussion. It's a big enough step, creating some sort of consciousness, that whether you do it biologically or, in some sense, whether you do it through computers and artificial intelligence, it's the kind of thing there should be a social discussion and a social agreement about, rather than just letting it happen.
Special thanks this week to Madeline Lancaster, Gray Camp and Hank Greeley for their help with the show. If you'd like more information about their work, we'll include links to that in this episode's description on the Guardian website. If you've got any questions, queries or feedback, please get in touch via our email address, scienceweekly@theguardian.com. I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.